Well, Robert Fisk has become a household name for his often passionate writing on the Middle East. He's lived in Beirut for more than 30 years, working first as a correspondent for The Times and now for The Independent. He has drawn criticism at time as well as legions of fans for his staunch position on the Middle East and his belief that journalists should not be constrained in their language and their commentary on their views. His most recent book is a collection of essays, The Age of the Warrior. Robert Fisk's currently in Canada and joins us now on the line from Toronto. And thanks for being with us again, Robert. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Carry on.
Let's go back, if you don't mind, to the beginning of your career as a Mideast correspondent. Did you ask to go there?
No, I was actually covering in 1976 the aftermath of the Portuguese Revolution, and I was sitting on a beach in a place I remember well called Porto Covo, a very nice little beach alcove with sand and sea, and the postmistress shouted at me that I had a letter arrived. The post office included quite a lot of hens that were clucking over the floor, and when I opened the letter, it was from my then foreign editor, long dead I'm afraid, Louis Herron on the Times, who said that our correspondent in Beirut had just got married to a German billionaireess who didn't want to start her marriage in the middle of a civil war. Would I like to take his job and become Middle East correspondent of The Times? And I was 29 at the time. And he wrote in the letter, which I still have, of course, that it would be a great adventure and lots of sunshine. The sunshine bit was certainly true, though I didn't sort of anticipate 43 in the shade. But that's how I was offered the job, and I was 29, and I felt a bit like King Faisal being offered Iraq by Winston Churchill. So, of course, I said yes. So it wasn't that I was ambitious, but it seemed an opportunity one couldn't turn down, and off I went to Beirut.
Did you have any idea then that you would still be there, that this career would have unfolded 30 years on?
Absolutely not. I mean, in those days, and still today to some extent, it's a tradition on newspapers that after 3 or 4 years, the reporter moves on to somewhere else. The Beirut guy goes on to Moscow, and the Moscow guy goes on to Peking, and so on. And mercifully, I find, certainly on the British press, that habit is dying out now. I mean, what would happen is that just when you've got, you know, the language and the contacts, you go on, have to start all over again in a new country, in a new continent. So you ended up by knowing, this is a cruel thing to say about my colleagues, you ended up by knowing everything about nothing and nothing about everything. So what happened was, after 3 or 4 years, I was obviously encouraged to keep going. And then it became a habit to know on the Times, you know, Robert Fisk was a Middle East correspondent based in Beirut. And then when the Murdoch Times became just too insufferable to go on working for, we're talking now about 86, 87, I moved to the Independent with the same job in the same place and more or less, I fear, the same salary, but certainly the freedom to write, which I originally had on the Times. Indeed, a lot of other Times correspondents had moved to the Independent. And so I continued on from there, and the paper has always employed me on the basis that they want me to be their man in the Middle East.
You walked into the region at an extremely volatile time. You must have wondered what the hell you'd walked into.
Well, I tell you something. I thought it was volatile at the time, but compared to the hell disaster it is now, and the lethal place it is for journalists now, from Pakistan to Afghanistan to Iraq to Palestine, West Bank, Gaza, southern Lebanon, I would never have imagined when I went to Lebanon in 76 the level of violence and danger and political and military earthquake that I would witness as it got steadily worse right up to now. I mean, who would have imagined back in 76 the Twin Towers, the International Crimes Against Humanity of 9/11, the Sabra Shatila massacre of 82 by Israel's phalangist allies, the massacres at Hama by the Syrians, and so on and so forth. And of course, I had no idea. I thought I was covering the Lebanese civil war and possibly another Israeli invasion. But I didn't know that I'd be covering the 8-year Iran-Iraq war, the Bosnian war, the Kosovo war, the war between the Azerbaijanis and the Armenians, the invasion, the liberation of Kuwait, the Algerian war, the 2003 war in Iraq. I mean, it's looking back on it, I've often asked myself if I got the letter again from Louis Herron and I could wind the movie back. You can't wind the movie back, of course, but I mean, if I could, would I really have taken that job then?
And would you?
Well, I came back from a trip when I was doing the publicity for the French and Dutch editions of my previous book, The Great War for Civilization, and I'd been in Paris on the boulevards and I'd been on the, you know, walking beside the canals in Amsterdam and saw a lot of families who seemed happy and, I mean, everyone has their problems in life, but they haven't been through what I'd been through. And I went back to Beirut And I sat on my balcony over the Mediterranean, which is very beautiful. I have palm trees outside the house. And I looked across the sea and I asked myself that question. And I remembered Louis Heron's letter, which I've just recounted to you. And I decided that the answer was yes, I would.
It has come at a cost, though.
Well, you know, I'm 62 now, and when you get to that age, you can't actually wind back and start the whole life all over again. I mean, there might be, you know, you can get to 32 and say, okay, let's start again at 29, it doesn't matter. So you've got to settle for what you've got. And, you know, why did I do it? Well, I suppose at the end of the day, you know, you have to be tough to survive in the Middle East. You can't start breaking into tears and, you know, worrying about your own sensitivities. You've got to worry about the people you're working with, and they have to live there. They don't have visas to leave. They have pariah passports. They have to suffer. It shouldn't have to be the reporter. You know, if you don't like it there, you can leave. I suppose in the end, it became a bit like watching or reading this sort of extraordinary historical tragedy, like you know, reading Tolstoy, who's one of my favorite authors, particularly War and Peace, of course. And, you know, you sit up late at night reading and you say, well, just one more chapter. And then you suddenly look up and you realize it's way past midnight. And I say, well, just one more chapter. And before you know it, you look up and you can see the dawn between the curtains. And I think it's a bit like that. You want to see what happens next. Of course, you know, the story will go on long after you and I are dead. But I think there's this desire to see, I suppose in a cynical way, how far human folly can go. And also to find out whether it's possible for the absolutely hopeless situation in the Middle East at the moment, and there is no hope, to see if it's possible to get round the corner by getting people to acknowledge how hopeless it is and then find real solutions. I don't mean a solution in the obvious sense. I mean, you never solve a problem. You can resolve an issue, perhaps. But to see if it's possible to turn around. I mean, at the moment, I've come to the conclusion that unless militarily we, the West, move out of the Muslim world, there will be no end to this violence. And I cannot see an end to it. And all this talk about war on terror is a complete, it's shooting off at a side angle. We need to deal with issues like justice before we deal with issues like democracy. You can't build democracy on sand. It has to be on justice. And justice is what we will not deal with.
There are so many issues to go into in terms of the reasons why you have no hope, and I want to come back to them in some detail. Mm. But you say about the last 30 years, but go back to when you arrived. There was the Iranian Revolution. At the time, there was the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and the start of the civil war in Lebanon.
Yep.
These were actually same sites, but very different political entities at the time. Can you really say, therefore, that the cycle of violence there relates directly to what the West has done?
Well, number one, it's not a cycle of violence. It's a plunge into violence that's getting deeper and deeper. Look, one thing we have to recognize, or I have to recognize, that when I went to the Middle East more than 32 years ago, all the West's enemies, and I'm including Israel as an honorary Western nation in this particular example, all the West's enemies were nationalist, socialist, pro-Soviet. You know, they were the PLO or the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine or the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command or the Democratic Front for this and that. And all the various nations called themselves democratic and popular, which meant that they were neither democratic nor popular. I'm referring to the Arab countries at the time. And now, there isn't a single nationalist force against us. All our, quote, our, unquote, enemies are Islamist, whether they be Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the insurgents in Iraq, whether they be the Taliban, Hamas, Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad, Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, you name it. And this has been what has changed. Instead of fighting a nationalist force with whom one could make peace, one is suddenly fighting forces which are based upon a religion, rather than a set of ideological beliefs, which at that stage, for obvious reasons, the Cold War existed when I went to the Middle East, were based around the idea of Moscow and Soviet support, which, of course, has disappeared because the Soviet Union has disappeared. Is it the West's fault? Look, you can go back to the Crusades, you can go back to the Bible. It doesn't matter where you start. The fact of the matter is that after the First World War, a war in which my father, who was much older than my mum, fought himself, in 17 months, the West, the victors, which was principally Britain and France at that stage, we drew the borders of Northern Ireland, Yugoslavia, and most of the Middle East. And I spent my entire life reporting from Northern Ireland, Yugoslavia, and the Middle East.
You blame the legacy of that.
And watching the people in those borders burn. That's the point. Look, you can go back and say, what went wrong with Islam? I think it's a good question. I ask many Muslims this. Why didn't the Muslim world have the same renaissance that the European world had? I'm talking about the 16th, 17th century, the same questioning of religious edicts. So that, for example, we began to question the Bible and so on and so forth, whereas the Muslims with the enemy at the gates, we being the enemy at the time, after all, you know, we were a very powerful geographical military force during this period. When the enemy's at the gates, you don't turn around and start questioning your religious texts or your leadership. So I think that it wasn't necessarily, you know, it wasn't a Muslim characteristic not to question the orthodox teachings of imams or leaders or caliphs or whatever. It was a force of circumstance historically that came about. It wasn't our fault, it wasn't their fault. But what we have now is a situation where we have a vast number of people stretching from the Atlantic in Morocco right across Asia. I mean, of course, I know there's a vast number of, you know, Muslims in Europe and America and indeed even in New Zealand. But the fact is we have a large number of people called Muslims who have not lost their faith, whereas we largely in the West have lost our faith. I mean, we don't call ourselves, you notice whenever a book is written, it's always Islam and the West. It's never Islam and Christendom, because there aren't many Christians left in Europe, possibly. I don't know. But the fact of the matter is that we have our armies in Afghanistan. We have military forces of some kind in Pakistan. We're in Iraq. We're in Uzbekistan. We're in Tajikistan. We're in Jordan. We're in Egypt. We're in Turkey. We're in Algeria. We're in Kuwait. We're in all these Arab countries. They don't have a single soldier or occupation force in any Western nation's capital. Now, why are we there? You know, that's the question you need to ask. Not is it are we to blame? Why are we there?
Well, let's look at the situation then, because to many people, perhaps most people in the West, the current situation in the region, particularly the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, stems from, rightly or wrongly, whatever the reasons given, stems from the 9/11 attacks.
Hold on a second. We were supporting the Mujahideen and Osama bin Laden against the Russians from 1980 onwards, and that was more than two decades before 9/11. We were deeply involved in supplying weapons to Afghanistan alone at that stage.
Understood. So explain then Osama bin Laden. First of all, can I establish that you believe he was directly involved in the 9/11 attacks?
Look, I think he was involved. When you say directly, I don't think he had a little map with the Twin Towers written on and, you know, elevations, aviation, fuel, etc. No. But I think that he knew something was coming, and I think he was involved either in the funding of it or the inspiration of it. I have no doubt the last words he said to me, and I've met him three times, were, "I pray to God that he will help us, or permit us," was his words, "to turn America into a shadow of itself." And when you have international crimes against humanity on the level and scale of 9/11, you've got to say, who has declared himself America's enemy? And that was bin Laden.
So his motivation, in your view, was what?
Well, he destroyed the Soviet army in Afghanistan, and he claimed it helped destroy the Soviet Union, which was an exaggeration, but it had enough measure of truth to make it fairly, you know, convincing. And he clearly thought that he could go on and do the same to the United States. Remember, at that stage, he had two major interests. One was to destroy the Saudi regime. I think he wanted to be the Caliph of Arabia. And the second thing was to rid the Gulf and the Muslim world of American and other Western forces. He didn't succeed, well, not yet, but that was his aim. So if you look at it through his eyes, I'm not suggesting that's a very healthy thing to do, but if you do look through his eyes, you could see that for him, 9/11 was the beginning of a real war, because it brought the Western forces into his sphere of influence, where Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and the other various Islamist groups, not necessarily people like Hamas or Islamic Jihad, they've never attacked Americans, but various Islamist groups could be turned around and fight on a battlefield in the Muslim world itself.
To achieve what? Because you talk about the West being in all these places, and the West needs to get out of all these places or there will be no peace.
No, I said the Western military must get out of
these places.
Westerners should.
That's what
I'm implying. Want to say for the time being. Thank you very much.
I'm suggesting that we're talking about the military there. So yeah. His act was, in fact, though, to provoke a war and to provoke, in many ways, a rather predictable response from the US.
Well, I mean,
not to get anyone out of anywhere.
The moment that George Bush decided to start invading countries in the Muslim world, he was the best ally of bin Laden. I should add something. I think bin Laden now is totally irrelevant. You know,
do you believe he's still alive?
I'm sure he's alive. But the point is that bin Laden is irrelevant now because he has created Al-Qaeda. And he did so. For him, that's his creation. Now, it no more matters now whether he's alive or dead, any more than, for example, you have a group of nuclear scientists and they create the atom bomb, which they did. If afterwards you can arrest them all or they can all die, the bomb is with us. The monster has been born. So it's irrelevant to me, frankly, whether bin Laden's alive or dead. I think he's alive, but that's not the point.
The thing is, though, if his aim is to get military, Western military, out of his nation and indeed out of the Muslim countries, his act...
You're getting it wrong. I think it is the aim of many millions of Muslims to get us militarily out of their countries, and that is what he's achieved. But it's not just him, you know, it's our behaviour that's done it as well. Have we not invaded Iraq? Do you really think we'd be fighting in Iraq today? No, we wouldn't. Of course we wouldn't. We may have to put up with Saddam, but we, after all, we fed him, we pampered him, we paid him, we opened our embassies in his country, we even gave him the components for chemical weapons. They came from America and, of course, from Germany. I mean, we would not be fighting there, but we chose to invade.
You did predict in response to 9/11 that the action of the West is about to bring total disaster upon its own head. The intractable nature of the war in Iraq is obvious now these years on. But hasn't that prediction proved to be an overreaction? We didn't get a World War III out of this.
Iraq is now a hell. I never predicted World War III. I said before Afghanistan that the British had failed, the Russians had failed, and the Americans and British would fail jointly again. And they are failing. The Taliban is taking more and more territory. Before America invaded Iraq, I said they want to create a democracy in Iraq. And they went in there and they have created a hell disaster for the people there. And the same hell disaster is beginning to embrace the West Bank and Gaza and southern Lebanon. We've got to get out. It's the same old thing I say over and over again.
The key issue, the central issue in these long-running battles is the issue of Israel and of Palestine.
And of oil.
Indeed. Let's deal with the first that I mentioned first of all. You have been quoted saying that you don't see a future for Israel. Are you serious about
that? No, I've never been quoted as saying that. I've never said that. That's not correct. I've said over and over again that there must be security for Israel if it's going to continue to exist, and that the only chance I see of a peace between Palestinians and Israelis is abeyance of UN Security Council Resolution 242, which calls upon the Israelis to withdraw their forces from territories occupied in the 67 war in return for the security of all states in the area. The same resolution also insists upon the inviolability of the acquisition of land through war. Now, if Israel could abide by that, and the Palestinians would have to abide by it too, I think there's still a chance of a peace between Israel and the Palestinians, and thus possibly throughout the Middle East, providing, of course, we started pulling our Abrams tanks and our Apache helicopters out. But that is as far as I can go at the moment.
Come back. Have you not said that you now doubt that Israel can survive? Not whether it should or shouldn't, that you doubt whether it can survive?
I said that I don't know if it will, not if it can. You see, you have to realize that, I talk to not just Israelis, but Jewish communities all over the world, particularly in the United States. And there's grave doubts among many liberal Jews in the United States, for example, whether Israel will actually survive. I mean, it can survive. It's got 154 nuclear warheads in the Negev Desert, et cetera, et cetera. But can it constantly rely forever upon U.S. largesse and America's total commitment to anything Israel wants to do, particularly the building of settlements for Jews and Jews only on Arab-owned land, which is one of the greatest things that sticks in the minds of Arabs and Muslims. If Israel wants to continue to exist, and remember there have been a lot of countries like Yugoslavia we thought would always exist, and it turned out the people didn't want them to, but if Israel is going to continue to exist, it must have peace, and it is not having peace, and it is having constant war, and it's got to break out of that somehow. We've got to help it. But if it's going to go on building territory and taking territory illegally under international law from other people, I don't think it's going to have peace, and thus its future is constantly going to be in doubt.
It argues in terms of the lands that it still holds after the 1967, the Six-Day War. It argues the land for peace argument, that if it retreats from those boundaries, it has nothing to negotiate with in terms of peace.
Look, UN Security Council resolutions are meant to be obeyed. We force other people to abide by them, Saddam Hussein, for example. Why can't Israel? When you say they have nothing more to bargain with, a peace treaty is not a bargaining, it's not a gamble, it's not like going to the casino, it's about justice. And if Israel goes back to the 67 borders, not the international borders decreed by the United Nations, which are much smaller, but it just goes back to 67, then I think there's a chance for peace, which means that West Jerusalem can become the capital of Israel, East Jerusalem can become the capital of, quote, Palestine, unquote. It doesn't really exist at the moment, as you're well aware. And there could be the foundation of peace. After all, the Oslo Agreement was meant to be based upon the two.
How does one achieve this? Because there was much optimism at the end of the Clinton administration that they were very, very close to a deal. And from reading I have done on this about some senior negotiators involved, Dennis Ross is one I would name, it was Arafat. It was the Palestinian side that in the end sunk
Dennis Ross gave a highly partial account of what happened. What at those final talks Yasser Arafat was offered. And Arafat was no friend of mine. I thought he was a cynical, corrupt old man, so don't have any illusions about that. But what Arafat was offered at the end of the day was about 22% of the original mandate Palestine, because although in theory it was being offered 40% or 39% or something, if you chopped off the various cordon sanitaire and the areas where he wouldn't be allowed to build houses and the areas which would remain settlements, he hardly got anything out of it. Arafat could not have returned to Gaza or the West Bank from those negotiations and remain the leader of the PLO with any kind of integrity.
All right, what you've just illustrated is that it isn't a simple situation, that the negotiations are incredibly detailed, with these vested interests
on
both sides.
Hold on a second. I think it's a mistake to say that the Palestine-Israel conflict, or the Middle East as a whole, is an incredibly complex issue which we can't grasp, etc., etc. It is not that complex. It's about justice. That Israel, if it wants to have a territory, it has a territory. It's internationally recognized. It is a state among the nations. It exists. When I go in there, I show my passport at Tel Aviv Ben-Gurion Airport and enter the state of Israel. It's there. I can't do the same in Palestine because it doesn't exist. If we're going to have a two-state solution, and Mr. Bush claims he wants that, and Mr. Ehud Olmert claims he wants it, though he's a dead duck now for obvious reasons, then we need to have serious negotiations based on 242, which was meant to be the foundation of the Oslo Agreement. But we can't have those negotiations because, as we know, Israel does not want to relinquish East Jerusalem, and Barack Obama goes out to Jerusalem and says basically the same thing. I mean, where are we going to go from here when we have America constantly, in effect, giving its Middle East policy over to the Israelis? If it would be fine, it can lend its support to Israel, and certainly to Israel's security, but it's got to lend its full support for the Arabs as well.
It is a nation that is under siege, though. You would agree with that by your own observations.
You mean that Israeli-Palestinian tanks, rather, are in Tel Aviv? I don't think so. Look, Israel is the most powerful nation in the Middle East. But as long as it goes on taking other people's territory in the West Bank, it's not under siege, it's expanding, isn't it?
It lives in fear, not only of the attacks that happen on its borders,
but of
neighbours.
I don't
want to justify
its position. I would live in fear from you.
I don't want to justify its position. But would you agree it is a nation and a people that believes itself under siege?
Look, I repeat to you, many Israelis, particularly on the intellectual left, I know, but others too, believe that the policy of the government is to make them think that they're under constant threat and must live in fear. I don't want Israelis to live in fear. I shouldn't think they should ever be under threat. But they are, but you've got to ask the question, why? If I come and take the bottom of your garden away, you'll get a lawyer and you'll sue me, and I'll say, oh, I'm under threat from you. Now, come on, you can't live like that. The Palestinians have lots of faults. They've made lots of terrible, terrible mistakes, and many of them, in my opinion, have gone towards morally evil things. The suicide bomber is an executioner of the innocent. We all know that. And if you're going to talk about, for example, existential threats or real threats like Iran, which I don't think is a genuine threat, because if they fire nuclear missiles at Israel, they're going to destroy the entire Palestinian population. Yes, Ahmadinejad is a crackpot, but we have to live in a real world. I mean, one of the things that we're not discussing, for example, is the fact that the Israeli authorities, either through intermediaries or directly, talk to Hamas. They talk to Islamic Jihad. They talk to the Iranians through Germany. They talk to the Syrians through Turkey. Negotiations are underway. There's no point in saying, oh, we're under threat. Israel is actually talking to all its so-called
enemies.
Talking to Israel. It's a fact.
Do you see a resolution to this crisis in your lifetime?
No, absolutely not. I think it's reached such an incendiary stage now that we will never recover any kind of legitimate position within the Middle East, the Muslim Middle East.
Well, is
I'm
war inevitable?
About the Israeli-Palestinian thing for the moment. I'm talking about Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, which is the most dangerous country at the moment. Here you have the so-called ally in the war on terror, which has nuclear weapons and it's packed with Talibans and al-Qaeda people. But we don't want to talk about Pakistan. We want to call Iran the threat, you see.
What is your take on the change of power, indeed, in Pakistan and what that does to the dynamics of the region?
Look, I think Pakistan is such a deeply corrupted country. From the president to the would-be prime minister to the man who wants to be the next president to the former president to the police force, It's got an vast intelligence apparatus that effectively works for the Taliban and props up the insurgency against the British and the Americans and Canadians and other Western forces in Afghanistan. It's a country where even down to the smallest village policeman, you have to use bribes. I go to Pakistan. You have to. I can't even drive now from Peshawar, for example, to Islamabad, the capital, without handing out bribes to policemen at checkpoints. This is a country in total, absolute decline. Mm-hmm. It's a very sad thing because it's a beautiful country and Pakistani people are lovely people, but it is terribly dangerous place. And I think at the moment it continues its downward path despite the abdication, thank God, of the last dictator we had, who was President Musharraf.
You've suggested one reason for what you certainly see as bad policy being pursued by the Western powers is that those leaders who've made the big decisions, George Bush, Dick Cheney, Tony Blair, have no personal experience of war. Do you think that would seriously have altered the decisions they made? You mentioned oil, for example, and the motive that that plays as well. That would seriously have changed their decisions in recent years?
Look, it's not the only thing. I pointed out that it was one of the dangerous elements. Look, what has happened is that when you've got a presidency and a prime minister's, and this implies, I think, all the members of your cabinet as well, John McCain, if he became president, would be a single exception because, of course, he was in the Vietnam War. You've got a whole collection of ministers, statesmen, prime ministers and presidents across the Western world whose only experience of war is Hollywood and television. And they treat war as a policy option. That's where Mr. Blair went wrong, for example. War is not a policy option. It's the total failure of the human spirit. In the Second World War, I mean, look how reluctantly Britain went into war in 1939. It was because almost the entire British cabinet had fought in the First World War. They were trying to avoid it. Unfortunately, Hitler had fought in the First World War and wanted another war, but that's a different historical issue. The fact is that even as I grew up, I mean, the prime ministers of Britain, when I was a boy, Macmillan, Churchill, Attlee, even when I was a Northern Ireland correspondent, before I became a foreign correspondent for the Times, the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, William Whitelaw, had been in the crossing of the Rhine in the Second World War. All these people knew the heavy burden that war meant. But today, they don't. They go to war as if it's a throw of the dice, as if it's, oh, well, we didn't get what we wanted through politics. Let's have a go with a war.
We talked earlier about how bad things have become over the time that you've been in the Middle East, but has anything improved since that time? I mean, look at Lebanon, your chosen home. It had enjoyed some measure of peace and civility until the 30-day war of Israel.
It had a certain amount of, that's a little bit pushing it. I mean, we had some pretty terrible bombardments in 93 and 96, but yes, I take your point. Look, I can tell you one thing in the context of Lebanon, which has been an enormously encouraging sign, but only on that small national level, not in the whole Middle East. And that is that during the Civil War from 1975 to 1990, in which 150,000 Lebanese and Palestinians, most of them civilians, were killed, many Lebanese sent their children abroad to be educated for their own safety. And many of them have come back to Lebanon as young people, well-educated in America, France, Britain, wherever. And they've turned their back on sectarianism and civil war. They don't want another civil war and they refuse to have one. The problem is, and here we go back to your original question again about how much are we to blame, the French mandate set up in Lebanon a system of government that doesn't work, which is a sectarian system of government, where the president always has to be a Christian Maronite, where the prime minister always has to be a Sunni Muslim, where the speaker of parliament always has to be a Shiite Muslim. And as long as you have that confessional system, you can never have a modern state because it won't be founded on those who are most able to rule the country. But if you then deconfessionalize Lebanon, if you take away its sectarianism, it won't be Lebanon anymore. I often describe it to friends as being a Rolls Royce. It's got wonderful, you can smell the leather seats, it's got beautiful engine, but unfortunately it's got square wheels.
Central premises, the Western military need to get out of all these nations. It seems
that's premise number one.
Yeah. But it seems to be a heck of a leap that if just that happened, everything would be sweet, everything would be peace.
It won't. It won't. Of course.
So what would happen? What would come in?
Well, look, the British got out of Palestine in 1948, and we knew there'd be a war. The British got out of India in 1948, and we knew there'd be a war. But although the legacy we left behind, for example, partition between Pakistan and India, and that really is a British responsibility, by the way, we're going back to Attlee, Mountbatten, and so on. Despite that, the whole region has recovered from our withdrawal. I don't know if there'd be a civil war in Iraq or not. I don't think there would, frankly. Afghanistan, that's something different. I think it'll probably partition itself and part of Pakistan will be lost to a new country called Pashtunistan, which would stretch almost up but not quite to Kabul. You know, we can sit down and draw maps together. But then again, we Westerners have always
We've
been
done
drawing
that before,
maps of the region, haven't we?
Indeed. I think...
Look, we can't say everything will be sweet and wonderful, but it won't be sweet and wonderful if you stay, that's for certain.
I thank you for your time again, Robert Fisk, the long-serving foreign correspondent based in Lebanon. He's speaking to us there from Canada. His latest book is a collection of essays called The Age of the Warrior. Earlier books, of course, The Great War for Civilization, a long-time independent correspondent for the Independent newspaper, that is.